dinner and sat blissfully blinking and puffing, quite unable to remember what yesterday's conversation had been about. I think you are partly right. Our disagreement lies in the fact that you consider personal interests the motive power, while I think every man with a certain degree of education ought to be interested in the general welfare. You may be right in thinking that activity backed by material interest is best, but your nature is altogether prime sautière, as the French say. You want passionate, energetic activity or nothing at all. Lievin listened to his brother, but understood absolutely nothing, and did not wish to understand. He was only afraid his brother might put some question which would elicit the fact that he was not paying attention. "That's what it is, old chap," said Koznishev, patting Konstantin's shoulder.
"Yes, of course.
But what matter? I don't insist on my view," replied Lievin, with a guilty, childlike smile. "What can I have been disputing about?" he thought. "Of course I was right, and he was right too, so it's all right. But I must go round to the office." He rose, stretching himself and smiling. Koznishev smiled too. "Shall we go for a stroll together?" he said, not wishing to part from his brother, who seemed to be exhaling freshness and vigour. "Come along, we could call in at the office if you want to."
"Oh, dear me," exclaimed Lievin, so loudly that he scared Koznishev.
"What's the matter?"
"How's Agafya Mikhailovna's arm?" asked Lievin, slapping his head. "I'd forgotten all about it."
"Much better."
"Well, I'll run and see her all the same. You won't have got your hat before I'm back."
And his heels clattered swiftly down the stairs, making a noise like a rattle. Chapter 7 Oblonsky had gone to Petersburg to fulfil a very necessary duty, which to officials seems most natural and familiar, though to laymen it is incomprehensible, that of reminding the ministry of his existence, without the performance of which right continuance in government service is impossible. Having taken away with him all the money there was in the house, he contrived, while attending to duty, to pass his time very pleasantly, going to races and visiting at country houses. Meanwhile, to curtail expenses, Dolly and her children moved to the country. She went to Ergushevo, the estate which had formed part of her dowry, about 35 miles distant from Lievin's Pokrovsk, and the very place where in spring the forest had been sold. The old mansion on the estate had been pulled down long ago, but there was a smaller house which had been enlarged and decorated by the prince. Some 20 years before, when Dolly was still a child, that house had seemed roomy and convenient, though in common with all houses of the kind it stood away from the drive and had not a south aspect. It was old and beginning to decay. In the spring, when Oblonsky went there to sell the forest, Dolly had asked him to look over the house and have all necessary repairs done. Like all guilty husbands, Oblonsky was very anxious about his wife's comfort, so he looked over the house himself and gave orders to have everything done that seemed to him necessary. According to him, it was necessary to reupholster the furniture with new cretonne, to put up curtains, make the garden tidy, plant flowers, and build a bridge by the lake. But he forgot many other things which were essential, and thus caused Dolly a great deal of trouble. Try as he would to be a considerate husband and father, Oblonsky never could remember that he had a wife and children. He had the tastes of a bachelor and understood no others. When he returned to Moscow, he informed his wife that all was being prepared, that the house would look like a new toy, and advised her to move thither. Her departure for the country suited Oblonsky in every way. It was good for the children, expenses would be cut down, and he would be freer. His wife, on the other hand, considered going to the country for the summer to be absolutely necessary for the children, especially for the little girl who had not recovered her health after the scarlet fever, and also in order to escape the humiliation of small debts for fuel, fish, boots, and so on, which tormented her. Besides this, she liked the idea of going to her house in the country because she intended to get her sister, Kitty, who was to return from abroad at midsummer and who had been ordered bathing, to join her there. Kitty wrote from her watering place that nothing seemed so attractive as spending the summer with Dolly at Ergushevo, which was full of childhood's memories for both of them. The first days in the country were very trying for Dolly. In her girlhood she had lived there, and it had left an impression on her mind as a place of refuge from all the unpleasantness of town. Life there, though very plain, Dolly was reconciled to that, was cheap and comfortable. Everything was cheap there and easy to get, and it would do the children good. But when she came there as mistress of the house, she saw that things were quite different from what she had expected. The day after her arrival it poured with rain, and in the night the rain came through into the passage and nursery, so that the children's beds had to be carried into the drawing-room. There was no scullery maid. Of the 9 cows, some, according to the dairymaids, were about to calve, others had calved for the first time, some were too old, and the rest were difficult to milk, so there was no butter and scarcely enough milk even for the children. There were no eggs. It was impossible to get a chicken, and they were obliged to boil and roast tough, old, purple-coloured roosters. No peasant women could be got to scrub the floors. They were all out planting potatoes. It was impossible to go for a drive, because one of the horses was restive and would not run in harness. There was no place for bathing, the river banks being all trampled over by the cattle and exposed to the road. It was not even possible to walk in the garden, because the fence was broken and the peasants' cattle could get in, and the herd included a terrible bull that was given to bellowing and would therefore probably toss. There was nowhere to hang dresses, because what few wardrobes there were would not shut or else opened of themselves when anyone passed by. There was no mangle in the laundry, not even an ironing board, and no large pots or pans. Dolly, meeting with these difficulties, so terrible from her point of view, instead of finding peace and rest, was at first driven to despair. She bustled about and did her utmost, but feeling the hopelessness of her position, had to fight with the tears that rose every moment to her eyes. The steward, formerly a non-commissioned officer to whom Oblonsky had taken a fancy and whom he had promoted from hall porter to steward because of the man's handsome and respectful appearance, took no interest in his mistress's troubles, only saying in a deferential tone, "Quite impossible. People are so abominable," and did nothing to help her. The position seemed irremediable. But just as in other households, there was here in the Oblonsky's house one inconspicuous yet most important and useful person, Matryona Filimonovna. She consoled her mistress, assuring her that everything would shape itself. This phrase was her own, and Matvey had learnt it from her, and she went to work deliberately and without excitement. She at once made friends with the steward's wife, and on the very day of the removal drank tea with her and with the steward beneath the laburnums, discussing arrangements. A club was soon established beneath the laburnums, consisting of Matryona Filimonovna, the steward's wife, the village elder, and the office clerk, and by means of this club the troubles began gradually to subside, so that in a week's time everything had really shaped itself. The roof was mended, a scullery maid, a relative of the elder's, was engaged, hens were bought, the cows gave enough milk, the garden was fenced in, a mangle was made by the carpenter, hooks were put into the wardrobes which no longer opened at their own sweet will, an ironing board covered with coarse cloth lay across the arm of a chair and a chest of drawers in the maid's room, and the smell of hot irons soon pervaded the room.
"There, you see, and you were quite in despair," said Matryona Filimonovna, pointing to the board.
Even a bathing house was constructed out of straw-plaited screens. Lily started bathing, and at least part of Dolly's expectations were fulfilled, if not that of a quiet, at least that of a comfortable country life. Dolly could not be quiet with 6 children, of whom one would fall ill, another be in danger of falling ill, a third be in want of something, a fourth show symptoms of something bad in his disposition, etc., etc. Very, very rare were the short intervals of quiet. But these cares and anxieties were the only kind of happiness possible for Dolly. Had it not been for them, she would have been left to her thoughts about the husband who did not love her. Besides, Painful as were for a mother the fear of illness and sorrow at the appearance of evil tendencies in her children, those children were already beginning to repay her care by affording her small joys. These joys were so trifling as to be as imperceptible as grains of gold among the sand, and in moments of depression she saw nothing but the sand. Yet there were brighter moments when she felt nothing but joy, saw nothing but the gold. Now in the country's solitude she grew more often aware of these joys. Often when watching her children she made great efforts to convince herself that she was mistaken, that being their mother she was not impartial, and yet she could not help telling herself that they were charming children, all the six, each in his or her own way, all of them such as are rarely to be met with, and she was happy in them and proud of them. Chapter 8. At the end of May, when the house was more or less in order, Dolly received from her husband an answer to her letter of complaint. He wrote asking her to forgive his not having seen to everything and saying that he would come as soon as possible. That possibility, however, had not been fulfilled, and up to the beginning of June Dolly was still living without him in the country. On the Sunday before St. Peter's Day, Dolly took all her children to communion. When talking intimately with her mother and sister, Dolly often astonished them by her freedom of thought on religious matters. She had a strange religion of her own, firmly believing in the transmigration of souls and not caring about church dogmas. But in her family she fulfilled, not merely to set an example, but with her whole heart, all that the church demanded, and was very uneasy because for about a year the children had not received communion. So now, with the entire approval of Matryona Filimonovna, she resolved that this ceremony should be performed. Several days previously she decided how all the children should be dressed. New frocks were made, old ones altered, hems and frills let down, buttons sewn on, and ribbons got ready. One of the frocks, which the English governess had undertaken to alter, was the cause of much bad blood. The governess put the bodice darts in the wrong places, cut out the armholes too big, and nearly spoilt the dress. It fitted so tight round Tanya's shoulders that it was painful to see her. But Matryona Filimonovna was inspired to insert wedge-shaped pieces and to make a fichu to cover the defect. The frock was put right, but it very nearly caused a quarrel with the governess. However, in the morning everything was right, and toward 9 o'clock, the hour till which the priest had been asked to defer Mass, the children, beaming with joy, stood in all their finery by the carriage at the porch, waiting for their mother. Instead of the restive raven, the steward's brownie had been harnessed to the carriage on Matryona Filimonovna's authority, and Dolly, who had been detained by the cares of her own toilette, came out in a white muslin dress and took her seat in the carriage. Dolly, somewhat excited, had dressed and done her hair with care. At one time she used to dress for her own sake in order to look well and be attractive. Later on, as she grew older, dressing became less and less agreeable to her because it made the loss of her good looks more apparent. But now it again gave her pleasure and excited her. She was not dressing for her own sake, not for her own beauty, but in order, as the mother of all those charming children, not to spoil the general effect. She gave her mirror a last glance and was satisfied with herself. She looked well, not in the way she had wished to look when going to a ball, but well for the object she had in view at present. There was no one in church except peasants, innkeepers, and their womenfolk, but Dolly saw, or thought she saw, the rapture produced in them by her children and herself. The children were not only beautiful in their fine clothes, but were also very sweet in their behaviour. It's true Alyosha did not stand very well. He kept turning round to see the back of his jacket, but nevertheless he was wonderfully sweet. Tanya stood like a grown-up person and looked after the little ones. Little Lily was charming in her naive wonder at everything around, and it was difficult to repress a smile when, having swallowed the bread and wine, she said in English, "More, please." On the way home, the children were very quiet, feeling that something solemn had taken place. At home, also, all went well, only at lunch Grisha began whistling and, what was still worse, would not obey the governess and had to go without his pudding. Dolly would not have sanctioned any punishment on such a day had she been present, but she was obliged to support the governess and so confirmed the sentence that Grisha was not to have pudding. This rather spoilt the general joyfulness. Grisha cried and said he was being punished, although it was Nikolenka that had whistled, and that he was not crying about the pudding, he didn't mind that, but because of the injustice. This was too sad, and Dolly decided to speak to the governess and get her to forgive Grisha, and went off to find her. But as she was passing through the dancing room, she saw a scene which filled her heart with such joy that tears came to her eyes, and she pardoned the little culprit herself. The little fellow was sitting on the ledge of the corner window of the dancing room, and beside him stood Tanya with a plate. On the plea of giving her dolls some dinner, she had obtained leave from the governess to take her plateful of pudding to the nursery, but had brought it to her brother instead. Still crying over the injustice done him, he ate the pudding, muttering between sobs,
"Eat some yourself. Let us both eat together."
Tanya, affected first by pity for Grisha and then by the consciousness of her own virtuous action, also had tears in her eyes, but did not decline to eat her share of the pudding. When they saw their mother, they were frightened, but glancing at her face, they knew they were acting rightly, and, with their mouths full of pudding, began to laugh and wipe their smiling lips with their hands, smearing their beaming faces with tears and jam.
"Dear me, your nice white frock, Tanya! Grisha!"
cried their mother, trying to save the frock, but smiling a blissful, rapturous smile. The new clothes were taken off. The little girls had their overalls and the boys their old jackets, and orders were given to harness, to the steward's chagrin, his brownie again, to take the whole family mushroom hunting and later to the bathing house. The sound of rapturous squealing filled the nursery and did not cease till they started on their drive. They gathered a basketful of mushrooms. Even Lily found one. Previously, Miss Hull used to find one and point it out to her, but this time Lily herself found a fine big one and there was a general shout of delight. "Lily's found a mushroom!" After that, they drove to the river, left the horses under the birch trees, and entered the bathing house. Terenty, the coachman, tied to a tree the horses that were swishing their tails to drive away the flies, stretched himself full length in the shade, pressing down the high grass, and smoked his pipe, while from the bathing house came the sound of the incessant, merry squealing of the children. Although it was troublesome to look after all the children and keep them out of mischief, and difficult to remember whose were all those little stockings and drawers, not to mix up the shoes of all those different feet, to untie, unbutton, and then fasten up again all the tapes and buttons. Yet Dolly, who had always been fond of bathing and considered it good for the children, knew no greater pleasure than bathing them. To hold in her hands all those plump little legs, to draw on their stockings, to take the naked little bodies in her arms and dip them in the water, to hear them shrieking now with fear and now with delight, and to see her cherubs gasping and splashing with their frightened yet merry eyes, was a great joy. When half the children were dressed again, some smartly dressed peasant women who had been gathering herbs came up and halted shyly by the bathing house. Matryona Filimonovna called to one of these to ask her to dry a bath sheet and a chemise that had fallen into the water, and Dolly entered into conversation with them. The peasant women, who had begun by laughing behind their hands without comprehending her questions, soon became bolder and more talkative, and at once captivated Dolly by their frank admiration of her children.
"Just look at the little beauty, as white as sugar," said one, gazing admiringly at Tanya and stroking her head.
"But she's thin."
"Yes, she's been ill."
"Why, you seem to have been bathing that one, too," said the other woman, looking at the baby.
"No, she's only 3 months old," Dolly answered proudly.
"Dear me!"
"And have you any children?"
"I had four.
Two are left, a boy and a girl. I weaned her in the spring.
How old is she?
In her second year.
Why did you nurse her so long?
Oh, it's our custom.
And the conversation turned upon the topic that interested Dolly more than any other. Confinements, children's illnesses, husbands' whereabouts, and whether they came home often. Dolly did not want to part from the peasant women. Their conversation pleased her so much because their interests were exactly similar to hers. What pleased Dolly most was the women's evident admiration for the great number of children she had and their loveliness. The women amused her and offended the English governess, who noticed that she was the object of their laughter, which she did not understand. One of the young women was watching the governess, who was dressing after all the others, and seeing her put on a third petticoat, could not refrain from remarking,
"Look at her! She's wrapping herself up and wrapping herself up and hasn't got enough round her yet!"
And all the women burst out laughing. Chapter 9. Surrounded by her children, all freshly bathed and with heads still damp, Dolly, with a kerchief tied round her own head, was nearing home when the coachman said,
"There's a gentleman coming. I think it's the Pokrovsk squire."
Dolly leant forward and was pleased to see the familiar figure of Levin, who in a grey hat and coat was walking toward them. She was always glad to see him, but on this day was more pleased than ever, because he would now see her in all her glory. No one could understand the dignity of her position better than Levin. On seeing her, he found himself confronted by just such a picture of family life as his fancy painted.
"You are like a hen with her chickens, Darya Alexandrovna."
"Oh, I'm so glad," said she, holding out her hand.
"You're glad, yet you never sent me word. My brother is staying with me. It was from Stepan I heard at last that you were here."
"From Stepan?"
asked Dolly in a surprised tone.
"Yes, he wrote that you had moved here, and he thought I might be of some use to you," replied Levin,
and having said this, grew confused. Without finishing what he was going to say, he continued walking beside the trap, breaking off twigs from the lime trees and biting them. He was confused because he imagined that Dolly might not like to accept the help of a stranger in matters that ought to be attended to by her husband. She really did not like the way Oblonsky had of forcing his family affairs upon strangers, and knew at once that Levin understood this. It was for his quick perception and delicacy of feeling that Dolly liked him.
"Of course, I understand that this only meant you wanted to see me and was very pleased. I can well imagine how strange everything here must seem to you, used as you are to managing a townhouse, and if you require anything, I'm quite at your disposal."
"Oh, no," said Dolly. "At first it was inconvenient, but now everything is quite comfortable, thanks to my old nurse," she said, indicating the nurse who, aware that she was being mentioned, looked at Levin with a bright and friendly smile. She knew him, knew that he would be a good match for the young lady, and hoped the affair would come off.
"Won't you sit down, sir? We'll move closer together," she said to Levin. "No, I will walk. Children, who'll race the horses with me?"
Though the children did not know Levin well and did not remember when they had last seen him, they did not feel toward him any of that strange shyness and antagonism so often felt by children toward grown-up people who pretend, which causes them to suffer so painfully. Pretense about anything sometimes deceives the wisest and shrewdest man, but however cunningly it is hidden, a child of the meanest capacity feels it and is repelled by it. Whatever Levin's defects may have been, there was not a trace of pretense about him. Therefore the children evinced toward him the same friendliness that they saw in their mother's face. The two eldest, responding to his invitation, at once jumped out to him and ran with him as they would have done with their nurse, Miss Hull, or their mother. Lily wanted to go too, and her mother handed her to him. He put her on his shoulder and ran on.
"Don't be afraid, don't be afraid, Darya Alexandrovna. There's no fear of my hurting or dropping her," said he, smiling brightly at the mother.
And as she looked at his easy, strong, considerate, careful, and ultra-cautious movements, The mother lost her fears and looked at them with a smile of approval. Here in the country, among the children, and in the company of Dolly, whom he found very congenial, Lievin's spirits rose to that childlike merriment Dolly liked so much in him. He ran about with the children, taught them gymnastics, amused Miss Hull by his broken English, and talked to Dolly about his rural occupations. After dinner, left alone with him on the veranda, Dolly alluded to Kitty. "Do you know Kitty is coming here to spend the summer with me?" "Really?" said he, flushing up. And to change the subject, he at once added, "Well then, shall I send you 2 cows? If you insist on squaring accounts, pay me 5 roubles a month, if your conscience allows it."
"No, thank you. We're getting on all right now."
"Well then, I will just have a look at your cows, and with your permission we'll give directions about the feeding. Everything depends on the feeding." To change the conversation, Lievin went on to explain to Dolly a theory of dairy farming which maintained that a cow was only a machine for the transformation of fodder into milk, and so on. While saying all that, he was passionately longing and yet dreading to hear every particular concerning Kitty. He feared that the peace of mind he had acquired with so much effort might be destroyed.
"Yes, but all that has to be looked after, and who is going to do it?" remarked Dolly unwillingly.
Having, with Matryona Filimonovna's help, got her household into working order, she did not care to make any change. Besides, she had no confidence in Lievin's knowledge of farming. Arguments about cows being milk-producing machines did not commend themselves to her, for she imagined that such arguments were calculated only to interfere with farming. All these matters appeared much simpler to her. All that was necessary, as Matryona Filimonovna said, was to give Spotty and White Flank more food and drink, and to see that the cook did not take the kitchen refuse to the laundress for her cow. That was clear. But arguments about cereal and grass feeding were questionable and vague. And above all, she was anxious to talk about Kitty. Chapter 10. "Kitty writes that she wishes for nothing so much as seclusion and quiet," said Dolly, after a pause in the conversation.
"And her health? Is she better?" asked Lievin anxiously.
"Yes, thank God, she has quite recovered. I never believed that she had lung trouble."
"Oh, I'm so glad," said Lievin. And Dolly thought she saw something pathetic and helpless in his face as he said it, and then silently looked at her.
"Tell me, Konstantin Dmitrich," said Dolly, with her kind, though slightly ironical, smile, "why are you angry with Kitty?"
"I? I'm not angry," said Lievin.
"Yes, you are. Why did you not call either on us or on them when you were in Moscow?"
"Darya Alexandrovna," said he, blushing to the roots of his hair, "I am surprised that one so kind as you are should not feel what the reason was."
"How is it that you have no pity for me, knowing as you do?"
"What do I know?" "You know I proposed and was rejected," muttered Lievin. And the tenderness he had a moment ago felt for Kitty was changed into a feeling of anger at the insult.
"Why did you think I knew?"
"Because everybody knows it. In that, at any rate, you are mistaken. I did not know it, though I had my suspicions."
"Well, anyhow, you know it now. All I knew was that something had happened that tormented her dreadfully, and she asked me never to speak about it. And since she had not told me, she won't have told anybody."
"Well, what did happen between you? Tell me."
"I've told you what happened."
"When was it?"
"When I last visited you."
"Do you know," said Dolly, "I am terribly, terribly sorry for her."
"You are suffering only through pride."
"That may be," said Lievin. She interrupted him. "But for her, poor child, I am terribly, terribly sorry. Now I understand everything.
Well, Darya Alexandrovna, please excuse me, he said, rising. Goodbye, Darya Alexandrovna. Au revoir.
No, wait a bit, she answered, holding him by the sleeve. Wait a bit. Sit down.
Please, please don't let us talk about it, said he, sitting down again, conscious as he did so that a hope which he had thought dead and buried was waking and stirring within him.
If I did not care for you, Dolly went on, the tears rising to her eyes, if I did not know you as well as I do, the feeling that seemed dead was coming to life again, rising and taking possession of Lievin's heart. Yes, now I understand it all, continued Dolly.
You can't understand it, you men who are free and have the choice. You always know for certain whom you love.
But a young girl in a state of suspense with her feminine, maidenly delicacy, a girl who only knows you men from a distance and is obliged to take everything on trust, such a girl may and does sometimes feel that she does not know what to say.
Yes, if her heart does not tell her.
Oh, no, the heart does tell her.
But just imagine. You men, having views on a girl, come to the house, get to know her, observe her, and bide your time, and when you are quite certain that you love her, you propose.
Well, it's not quite like that.
Never mind, you propose when your love is ripe, or when the balance falls in favour of one of those between whom your choice lies. But a girl is not asked. She is expected to choose for herself, yet she has no choice. She can only say yes or no.
Yes, a choice between me and Vronsky, thought Lievin. And the dead hope that had begun to revive in his soul died again and only weighed painfully on his heart.
Darya Alexandrovna, said he, in that way one may choose a dress or purchases, anything, but not love. The choice is made, and so much the better. A repetition is impossible.
Pride, that pride, said Dolly, speaking as if she despised him for the meanness of his feelings compared to those which only women know.
When you proposed to Kitty, she was just in that state when it was impossible for her to give an answer. She was undecided, undecided between you and Vronsky. She saw him every day, you she had not seen for a long time. I admit that had she been older, I, for instance, could not have been undecided in her place. To me, he was always repulsive, and so he has proved in the end.
Lievin recalled Kitty's answer. She had said, "No, it cannot be."
"Darya Alexandrovna," he replied dryly, "I value your confidence in me, but think you are mistaken. Whether I am right or wrong, that pride which you so despise makes any thought of your sister impossible for me. Do you understand me? Perfectly impossible."
I will only add just this. You understand that I am speaking about my sister, whom I love as much as my own children. I do not say she loves you. I only wish to tell you that her refusal proves nothing.
"I don't know," said Lievin, jumping up. "If you know how you hurt me. It is just as if you'd lost a child, and they kept on telling you, 'Now he would have been so-and-so, and might be living, and you rejoicing in him, but he is dead, dead, dead.'"
"How funny you are," said Dolly, regarding Lievin's agitation with a sad yet mocking smile. "Yes, I understand it more and more," she added, meditatively.
"Then you won't come to see us while Kitty is here?"
"No, I won't. Of course I will not avoid her, but whenever I can, I will try to save her the unpleasantness of meeting me."
"You are
very, very funny, Dolly repeated, looking tenderly into his face.
All right, then. Let it be as if nothing had been said about it.
What have you come for, Tanya? Said Dolly in French to her little girl, who had just come in.
Where is my spade, Mama?
I am speaking French, and you must answer in French. The little girl had forgotten the French for spade, so her mother told her, and went on to say, still in French, where she would find the spade. All this was disagreeable to Levin. Nothing in Dolly's house, or about her children, seemed half as charming as before. Why does she talk French with the children? He thought. How unnatural and false it is. And the children feel it. Teach them French and deprive them of sincerity, thought he, not knowing that Dolly had considered the point over and over again, and had decided that even to the detriment of their sincerity, the children had to be taught French.
Where are you hurrying to? Stay a little longer.
So Levin stayed to tea, though his bright spirits had quite vanished and he felt ill at ease. After tea he went out to tell his coachman to harness, and when he returned he found Dolly excited, a worried look on her face and tears in her eyes. In Levin's absence an event took place which suddenly put an end to the joy and pride that Dolly had been feeling all day. Grisha and Tanya had a fight about a ball. Dolly, hearing their screams, ran up to the nursery and found them in a dreadful state. Tanya was holding Grisha by the hair, and he, his face distorted with anger, was hitting her at random with his fists. Dolly's heart sank when she saw this. A shadow seemed to have fallen on her life. She recognized that these children, of whom she had been so proud, were not only quite ordinary, but even bad and ill-bred children with coarse animal inclinations, in fact, vicious children. She could think and speak of nothing else, and yet could not tell Levin her trouble. Levin saw that she was unhappy, and tried to comfort her by saying that it did not prove that anything was wrong with them, that all children fought. But as he spoke, he thought to himself, "No, I'll not humbug my children, and won't speak French with them, but I shan't have children like these. All that is needed is not to spoil or pervert children, and then they will be splendid. No, my children will not be like these." He said goodbye and left, and she did not try to detain him any longer. Chapter 11. In the middle of July, the elder from the village belonging to Levin's sister, which lay 15 miles from Pokrovsk, came to see Levin and report on business matters and on the hay harvest. The chief income from his sister's estate was derived from the meadows, which were flooded every spring. In former years, the peasants used to buy the grass, paying 7 rubles per acre for it. When Levin took over the management of the estate, he looked into the matter, and concluding that the grass was worth more, fixed the price at 8 rubles. The peasants would not pay so much, and Levin suspected them of keeping other buyers off. Then he went there himself and arranged to have the harvest gathered in partly by hired labourers and partly by peasants paid in kind. The local men opposed this innovation by all the means in their power, but the plan succeeded, and in the first year the meadows brought in almost double. The next and third years the peasants still held out, and the harvest was got in by the same means. But this year the peasants had agreed to get the harvest in and take 1/3 of all the hay in payment. Now the elder had come to inform Levin that the hay was all made, and that for fear of rain he had asked the steward to come, and in his presence had apportioned the hay and had already stacked 11 stacks of the landlord's share. From the elder's vague replies to Levin's questions as to how much hay the largest meadow had yielded, from his haste to apportion the hay without waiting for permission, and from the general tone of the peasant, Levin knew that there was something not quite square about the apportionment, and decided to go and investigate the matter himself. Levin arrived at his sister's village at noon and left his horse with a friendly old peasant, the husband of his brother's nurse. Wishing to hear particulars of the hay harvest from this old man, Levin went to speak to him in his apiary.
Parmionich, a loquacious, handsome old man, welcomed Levin joyfully, showed him over his homestead and told him all about the swarming of his bees that year. But to Levin's questions about the hay harvest, he gave vague and reluctant answers. This still further confirmed Levin's suspicions. He went to inspect the hay, examined the stacks, and saw that there could not be 50 cartloads in each. To put the peasant to the proof, Levin ordered the carts on which the hay was being moved to be fetched, and one of the stacks to be carried to the barn. There were only 32 loads in the stack. In spite of the elder's explanations that the hay had been loose but had settled down in the stacks, and his swearing that all had been done in a godly way, Levin insisted that the hay had been apportioned without his order, and that he would not accept the stacks as containing 50 loads each. After lengthy disputes, it was settled that the peasants themselves should take those 11 stacks, counting them as 50 loads each, and that the owner's share should be measured afresh. These disputes and the apportioning of the haycocks went on till it was time for the evening meal. When the last of the hay had been apportioned, Levin entrusted the rest of the supervision to the steward and seated himself on a haycock marked with a willow branch, looking with enjoyment at the meadow teeming with busy people. Before him, within the bend of the river, beyond a marsh, moved a line of gaily clad women, merrily chattering in their ringing voices, while the scattered hay was quickly forming into grey, waving ridges on the light green meadow. Men with hayforks followed the women, and the ridges grew into tall, wide and light haycocks. To the left, carts rattled along the bare meadow, and one after another the haycocks vanished, picked up in enormous forkfuls, and their places were taken by heavy carts, with their huge loads of scented hay overhanging the horses' backs.
"Make hay while the sun shines, and you'll have plenty," remarked the old beekeeper, sitting down beside Levin. "It's more like tea than hay. See them picking it up like ducklings picking up the food you've thrown to them," he added, pointing to where the hay was being loaded on the carts. "They've carted a good half since dinner time. Is that the last?" he shouted to a lad who was driving past, standing on the front of a cart and flicking the ends of his hempen reins.
"The last one, father!"
shouted the lad, reining in the horse and smilingly turning to a rosy young woman who, also smiling, sat inside the cart. Then he drove on again.
"Who is that? Your son?" asked Levin.
"My youngest," replied the old man with a smile of affection. "Fine fellow. Not a bad lad."
"And already married?"
"Yes, just over 2 years."
"Have they any children?"
"Children? All the first year he didn't understand anything, and we chaffed him," answered the old man. "Well, this is hay. Regular tea," said he again, in order to change the subject.
Levin looked more attentively at Vanka Parmionich and his wife. They were loading their cart not far away. Vanka stood inside the cart, patting and stamping down evenly in the cart the enormous bales of hay which his young wife first passed to him in armfuls and then pitched up on the fork. The young woman was working with ease, cheerfulness, and skill. The fork could not at once penetrate the broad-bladed, compressed hay, so she first loosened it with the prongs, then, with a quick and springy movement, putting all the weight of her body on the fork, quickly straightened her red-girdled figure and stood erect, her full bosom thrown forward beneath the pinafore, and turning the fork dexterously, she pitched the hay high up into the cart. Vanka, with evident desire to save her every moment of unnecessary exertion, hurriedly caught the hay in his outspread arms and smoothed it evenly in the cart. When she had lifted the remaining hay to him with a rake, she shook the chaff from her neck, straightened the kerchief that had slipped from her forehead, which showed white where the sun had not reached it, and crawled under the cart to help rope up. Vanka showed her how to do this, and burst out laughing at something she said. Strong, young, newly awakened love shone in both their faces. Chapter 12. The hay was roped. Vanka jumped down and, taking the bridle, led away the good, well-fed horse. His wife threw her rake on top of the load and, swinging her arms, went with vigorous steps to join the other women who had gathered in a circle. Having come out upon the road, Vanka took his place in the line of carts. The women, carrying their rakes over their shoulders, followed the carts, their coloured dresses gleaming brightly and their chatter ringing merrily. One of the women, with a strange, gruff voice, started a song and sang it to the end, when 50 powerful voices, some gruff and others shrill, all at once took it up with a will. The singing women were drawing nearer to Levin, and he felt as if a thundercloud of merriment were approaching. The cloud moved past, enveloping him and the haycock upon which he sat, and the other haycocks, the carts, the whole of the meadow, and the distant fields. They all seemed to vibrate and heave with the strains of that wild, madly merry song, interspersed with screams and whistling. Levin envied them their healthy gaiety and felt a wish to take part in that expression of the joy of living. But he could do nothing except lie and look and listen. When the company and their songs vanished out of sight and hearing, an oppressive feeling of discontent with his own lonely lot, his physical idleness and his hostility to the world overcame Levin. Some of those very peasants who had disputed with him about the hay, whom either he had wronged or who had tried to cheat him, those very peasants had bowed pleasantly to him, evidently not harbouring and unable to harbour any ill will toward him, being not only unrepentant, but even forgetful that they had been trying to cheat him. All had been drowned in the sea of their joyful, common toil. God had given them the day and the strength, and both the day and the strength had been devoted to labour which had brought its own reward. For whom they had laboured and what the fruits of their labour would be was an extraneous and unimportant affair. Levin had often admired that kind of life, had often envied the folk who lived it. But that day, especially after what he had seen for the first time of the relations between Vanka Parmionich and his young wife, it struck him that it depended on himself to change his wearisome, idle, and artificial personal life for that pure, delightful life of common toil. The old man who had been sitting beside him had long since gone home. The peasants who lived nearby had also gone home, and those from a distance had gathered together to have supper and spend the night in the meadow. Levin, unnoticed by them, still lay on the haycock, looking, listening, and thinking. The peasants who were staying in the meadow kept awake almost all the short summer night. At first the sounds of merry general talk and shouts of laughter over their supper could be heard, then songs and more laughter. The whole long day of toil had left upon them no trace of anything but merriment. Just before dawn all became silent. The sounds of night, the ceaseless croaking of frogs, the snorting of horses through the morning mist over the meadow, could alone be heard. Awaking to reality, Levin rose from his haycock and, glancing up at the stars, realized that the night was nearly over.
Well then, what shall I do? How shall I do it?
He asked himself, trying to find expression for what he had been thinking and the feelings he had lived through in that short night. All his ideas and feelings separated themselves into three different lines of thought. The first was how to renounce his old life and discard his quite useless education. This renunciation would afford him pleasure and was quite easy and simple. The second was concerned with his notion of the life he now wished to lead. He was distinctly conscious of the simplicity, purity, and rightness of that life, and was convinced that in it he would find satisfaction, peace, and dignity, the absence of which was so painful to him. But the third thought was the question of how to make the change from his present life to that other one. And here no clear idea presented itself to his mind. Should he have a wife? Should he have work and the necessity to work? Should he leave Pokrovsk, buy land, join a peasant commune, marry a peasant girl? How am I to do it? He again asked himself, and could find no reply. However, I have not slept all night and can't render a clear account of myself now, he thought. But I'll clear it up later. One thing is certain. This night has decided my fate. All my former dreams of a family life were nonsense. Not the right thing. Everything is much simpler and better than that. How beautiful, he thought, looking up at a strange mother-of-pearl-coloured shell formed of fleecy clouds in the centre of the sky just over his head. How lovely everything is this lovely night. And how did this shell get formed so quickly? A little while ago, when I looked at the sky, all was clear but for two white strips. My views of life have changed in just the same unnoticeable way. Leaving the meadow, he went down the high road toward the village. A slight breeze was blowing, and all looked grey and dull. There is generally a period of gloom just before daybreak, and the complete triumph of light over darkness. Shivering with cold, Lievin walked rapidly, with his eyes fixed on the ground. What's that? Who can it be coming? Thought he, hearing the tinkling of bells and raising his head. At a distance of 40 paces along the road on which he was walking, he saw a coach with 4 horses abreast and luggage on top approaching him. The horses were pressing close together, away from the ruts, but the skillful driver, sitting sideways on the box, guided them so that the coach wheels ran smoothly in the ruts. That was all Lievin noticed, and without wondering who might be inside, he glanced in at the window absent-mindedly. In one corner an elderly woman was dozing, and close to the window sat a young girl who had just wakened and was holding the ribbons of her white nightcap with both hands. Bright and thoughtful, full of that complicated refinement of a life to which Lievin was a stranger, she looked across him at the glow of dawn. At the very moment when this vision was about to disappear, her candid eyes fell on him. She recognized him, and joyful surprise lit up her face. He could not be mistaken. There were no other eyes in the world like them. In the whole world there was only one being able to unite in itself the universe and the meaning of life for him. It was Kitty. He guessed that she was on her way from the station to her sister's house at Ergushevo. All that had so disturbed Lievin during the sleepless night and all his resolutions vanished suddenly. He recalled with disgust his thoughts of marrying a peasant girl. There, alone, inside that coach on the other side of the road, so rapidly receding from him, was the one possible solution of that riddle which had been weighing on him so painfully of late. She did not look out again. The sound of the wheels could no longer be heard. The tinkling of the bells grew fainter. The barking of dogs proved that the coach was passing through the village, and only the empty fields, the village before him, and he himself walking solitary on the deserted road, were left. He looked up at the sky, hoping to find there the shell he had been admiring, which had typified for him the reflections and feelings of the night. There, in the unfathomable height, a mystic change was going on, and he could see no sign of anything like a shell, but a large cover of gradually diminishing fleecy cloudlets was spreading over half the sky, which had turned blue and grown brighter. It answered his questioning look with the same tenderness and the same remoteness. No, said he to himself. Beautiful as is that life of simplicity and toil, I cannot turn to it. I love her.
Chapter 13. None but those who knew Karenin most intimately knew that this apparently cold and sober-minded man had one weakness quite inconsistent with the general trend of his character. Karenin could not with equanimity hear or see a child or a woman weeping. The sight of tears upset him and made him quite incapable of reasoning. The chief of his staff and his secretary knew this, and warned women who came with petitions that they should on no account give way to tears if they did not want to spoil their case. "He will get angry and won't listen to you," they said. And in such cases the mental perturbation which tears produced in Karenin really found expression in hurried bursts of anger. "I can do nothing for you. Kindly go away," he would shout on these occasions. When Anna, on their way home from the races, announced to him what her relations with Vronsky were, and immediately hid her face in her hands and began crying, Karenin, despite his indignation with her, was as usual overcome by that mental perturbation. Being aware of this, and of the fact that any expression he could at that moment find for his feelings would be incompatible with the situation, he tried to conceal all signs of life within himself, and neither moved nor looked at her. That was the cause of the strange, death-like look on his face which had so struck Anna. When they reached home, he helped her out of the carriage and took leave of her with his usual courtesy, uttering non-committal words. He said he would let her know his decision next day. His wife's words, confirming as they did his worst suspicions, had given Karenin a cruel pain in his heart. This pain was rendered more acute by physical pity for her, evoked by her tears. But when alone in the carriage, to his surprise and joy, he felt completely relieved of that pity, and of the suspicions and jealousy that had lately so tormented him. He felt like a man who has just had a tooth drawn which has been hurting him a long time. After terrible pain and a sensation as if something enormous, bigger than his whole head, were being pulled out of his jaw, he feels, scarcely believing in his happiness, that the thing which has so long been poisoning his life and engrossing his attention no longer exists, and that it is possible again to live, think, and be interested in other things. What Karenin experienced was a feeling of this kind. It had been a strange and terrible pain, but it was past, and he felt he could again live and think of other things beside his wife.
Without honour, without heart, without religion. A depraved woman. I knew it and could see it all along, though I tried out of pity for her to deceive myself, thought he. And it really seemed to him that he had always seen it.
He recalled all the details of their past life, and details which he had not previously considered wrong now proved to him clearly that she had always been depraved.
I made a mistake when I bound up my life with hers, but in my mistake there was nothing blameworthy. Therefore I ought not to be unhappy. It is not I who am guilty, he said to himself, but it is she. She does not concern me. She does not exist for me.
What would happen to her and to her son, toward whom his feelings had changed as they had toward her, no longer occupied his mind. The one thing that preoccupied him was the question of how he could best divest himself of the mud with which she, in her fall, had bespattered him, of how to do it in the way which would be most decent, most convenient for him, and consequently fairest, and how he should continue his active, honest, and useful career.
I ought not to be unhappy because a despicable woman has committed a crime, but I must find the best way out of this painful situation in which she has placed me. And find it I will, said he to himself, frowning more and more. I'm not the first, and shall not be the last. And without taking into account the historical instances of wives' unfaithfulness, beginning with Menelaus and Labella,